Welcome to episode 167 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson, Syncom Smalltalk Product Evangelist. This week I have a presentation from ESUG 2009, Martin McClure of Gemstone talking about the process of building Ruby in Smalltalk for their glass project. If you have feedback on this or any other episode of Industry Misinterpretations, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can also head on over to iTunes and leave a comment for us. We would really appreciate it if you did that. You can head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast. And of course, you can interact with us in the Industry Misinterpretations group of Facebook and the Small Talkers group at Ning.
With a fairly large. We have customers that routinely run several thousand concurrent VMs, all sharing the same image or database. The database can be fairly large. We've tested it up to the terabyte scale, although all of our customers are running slightly smaller than that. They're only in the hundreds of gigabytes. It's relatively fast. We're probably not the very fastest at raw Smalltalk execution speed, but we're fairly fast. And we have a fairly impressive hardware. You can achieve about 10,000 megs a second, has been done with more pedestrian hardware, a couple thousand megs a second. The main thing, though, about this is that it's just Smalltalk. It's Smalltalk all the way down. It's just objects. You can save them. You don't have to deal with object positional mapping. You can make your object model what it wants to be for the problem. You don't have to make it look like tables and rows. All that's gone. Smalltalk all the way down. This is what we like to refer to as transparent persistence, which this particular screen here was a splash screen for one of the early glass releases, pre-releases, and an example of playing on the transparentness of glass and the transparent persistence. So we want to be able to bring that kind of transparent persistence to Ruby, and also have a fairly fast Ruby virtual machine. Ruby isn't known for speed. Yes?
Can you turn on the microphone?
The mic.
The
mic.
You want it louder?
It's not on.
Yes, it's on. Oh, it's on. Here, I will show you. I will turn it off. Okay, now it is on. A few of you sitting right down front may be able to read that. But at any rate, that's the whole thing. You can get an idea of the general level of complexity. So let's compare that to the Ruby parameter. Problem number one, there is no published Ruby parameter. There is no standard Ruby. You can't get a BNF for it anywhere. There's one that's way out of date from Ruby 1.4, and that one's probably erroneous and incomplete. Okay, so what do we have to work from? Well, the reference implementation, the original implementation, it's called MRI, which stands for Matt's Ruby Implementation. Matt's being Yukihiro Matsumoto, the creator of Ruby. So Matt's Ruby Implementation, MRI 1.86, which was the current release as of the time we started this project, has a file in it, a handwritten. It uses Bison to parse, which is a Yak variant, and which is in C. And it uses a handwritten .y file to specify the grammar and what you do with it. Okay, there's our stuff file. None of you can do that. It's 134 pages formatted the same font and setting as I formatted the Smalltalk BNF, which was 2 pages. So for comparison, there's where the Smalltalk BNF would fit in the Ruby parse.y. Now there is some stuff that isn't just strict BNF in parse.y. Parse.y is, however, a fairly big fraction of it. So that gives you an idea of how complicated the Ruby syntax is compared to the Smalltalk syntax. So what did we do? Well, we looked at what other implementations like Rubinius were doing, what people tended to be doing in the alternative Ruby implementations that were just getting started at that time, was they took this font and they hand-edited it to match the needs of their implementation.
And now, a short break for David Buck's Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. Software developers are used to the notion of variables having a scope. There are local variables, parameters, instance variables, and global variables, among others. In many systems, the compiler allows you to have variables with the same name in two different scopes. You might have a local variable with the same name as an instance variable, for example. When this happens, the innermost scope gets the name, and it's more difficult or impossible to directly access the variable in the outer scope. As a matter of style, however, I would claim that it's always a bad idea. If variables in the two scopes have the same name, then it's possible to get confused between the two scopes. If you get confused, the compiler isn't usually able to help out, and you end up with a runtime error. This practice is especially prevalent in Java setter methods, where they frequently name the parameters the same as the instance variable names, then prefix the instance variable name with this dot to reference it. I would much rather use a unique name for the parameter. I feel it makes for clearer code. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
Well, we were trying to get something basically running so we could demo it at a conference 100 days after we started the project. Doing that really didn't, and we're small young people, doing this didn't sound like fun, and it sounded like it would take a lot of time. So what do we do? You cheat. Okay, there's just no order there. So how do we cheat? So here's what we ended up doing. So we started with this, with a Smalltalk compiler, this section of the diagram. So we had a Smalltalk compiler front end that took Smalltalk source code and produced an intermediate representation. And then a compiler backend to turn that intermediate representation into bytecodes, small bytecodes. And both of these components were written in C, which allows our product to bootstrap itself. We built, unlike some implementations that haven't built a new image from scratch ever, we build new images many times a week because we build from scratch every time we build. So what we end up doing is we read in Ruby from a source code file, and we And then we poke that source code file out over a socket to a parse server, which is MRI Ruby 186, which has a parser built into it. And we run a little program there that's written, a little program that we wrote that also uses a component that was written by Ryan Davis, who's well known in the Ruby community and is a former Smalltalker, that reaches down into the C memory, pulls the abstract syntax tree out of the C memory once it's been parsed, and makes textual S expressions out of it. So we take those S expressions and then ship them back over the socket, put them into a very simple parser that's written in Smalltalk. It doesn't take much of a parser to turn S expressions into an abstract syntax tree. So we get an abstract syntax tree, and then we wrote this Ruby front-end compiler. Now this is fairly complicated. As you can imagine, with all that syntax specification, you get a lot of different node types in your abstract syntax tree, and the relation between them, there's a lot of different combinatorics of what kinds of structures you have to make to fulfill the Ruby language semantics. So what we spent most of our first 100 days, and we did come up with a demo in our first 100 days, and it did work, we spent most of our time working on this piece right here, the Ruby front-end compiler, which is written in Smalltalk. So we have the advantage of being able to work in Smalltalk there. Now, we used this basic structure for over a year. And recently, we moved beyond this phase. We no longer have to cheat quite as badly. What we now have is this. We have a Ruby parser written in Ruby. This is also written by Ryan Davis, although we spent about a month optimizing it and customizing it for our needs. But it uses RAC, which is a Ruby, written in Ruby YAC version, and has a .y file that we didn't have to write, and produces an abstract syntax tree in Ruby objects. Now, since the parser is written in Ruby, you can't bootstrap yourself up, so we still use the old way to bootstrap. But once you bootstrap and you've got your Ruby compiler, your Ruby parser in the in your persistent memory, then you're all good to go. You no longer need the MRI process.
Signature.
And if a block is passed, then that parameter will now refer. Does that help it?
Okay. What about the asterisk? You say you pass an array and it's treated as
I do have examples of that a little later. Okay. So ask me again if that isn't clear after we go through those. So the Smalltalk virtual machine expects the sender and receiver array to always match. You send, and the structure of the keyword selectors ensures that this has to be the case. You know, a given selector can only take a certain number of arguments. And therefore, when you build a Smalltalk virtual machine, you normally don't put in the stack context format, you don't put how many arguments you're passing because it's inherent. So, you know, at this particular sentence line, you always send two arguments, and that always binds to some method that expects two arguments, and you never have to match them up. So we have a problem there because, of course, our virtual machine doesn't pass along how many arguments you get. And we looked at the possibility of changing our stack frame format to add a word that says, here's how many arguments we're passing, and then it can, the send bytecodes and the methods of callbacks can adjust accordingly and maybe the Ruby semantics. But that would also penalize our Smalltalk execution because it would have to have these numbers of things pushed up the stack and slow them down a little bit. So, yeah, we decided to cheat.
What was that?
To cheat.
Okay. It's about this cheat.
So what do? We have the compiler synthesize what we call bridge methods. So when you define a method like this one, this defines a method with the selector of foo, and it takes two declared parameters here, a fixed parameter and a star parameter, which says that basically, you know, if I were to pass five arguments to this method, I would get the first one would be put into the parameter A, and the last four would be rolled up into a four-element array, which would be given to me as B. This compiles these 16 methods. The one in blue, foo colon star, as a selector, is the real one that contains the actual code that's here in these ellipses between the def and the end. And the other ones are all bridge methods, which just adjust the parameters, they assign the arguments appropriately and then pass it on. So we've got every combination here from 0 to 3 fixed arguments, and with and without the star, and with and without the ampersand. And so we actually compile things using these selectors. Now these selectors are not legal for Smalltalk, but only the Smalltalk compiler cares about that. The virtual machine doesn't care what characters are actually in a selector. It never looks at that. So as long as our compiler can make these, we know they won't collide with anything, and because they're not otherwise legal, and they work.
Do you always create these methods, or do you create them lazily?
No, they are always all created. We did consider lazy creation. It's certainly possible by using does not understand.
Oh, well, maybe because if you're not sending a message with the array, I mean, if you compile the code where it's sending the message to the array, and then you don't have the method, then you can create it. That's what I meant by lazy. Lazy, I compile that.
Yeah, you can't actually detect. Because you don't know.
Oh, okay.
You don't know. You don't know who might send this message, and because it's all dynamic late bound, when you compile the send site, you don't know which classes the receivers might be.
Right. Okay.
So you would have to do it at runtime through does not understand, which could be done.
Okay.
Also, there is the possibility of that you could have messages with more than 3 fixed arguments, and there's very few of those. We chose 0 to 3 based on the fact that it covers the vast majority of cases. And any additional ones, you can all roll up into 3 fixed arguments and a star, which is what we do. Yes?
So these messages, are they visible in the image? So are you really compiling source code for those, or are they just virtual somewhere in between?
They're real methods. They exist in the method dictionary. Because Ruby doesn't really have many tools for examining at this point, we are doing we're supporting tools in this file that Ruby programs are used to them, which is editing source code files in a text editor and running things. It's really very crude compared to what Smalltalk developers are used to. And I think that that's something that we will want to do at some point, is to provide some browser-like, you know, some better tools. And those tools will probably hide at least partially the existence of the bridge methods. But at this point, those tools don't exist, so it's really not an issue.
So what do legal calls to foo look like?
Okay, we have an example of that on the next slide. That's very good. Okay.
And now a short break for this week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Mumbai, India. JP Morgan Chase has a permanent position for an IB Tech Application Support Analyst Associate. They are looking for experience with Unix, Solaris, and Linux system administration, Gemstone, new server configuration, shell scripts, debugging skills, network storage solutions, and network communications. Experience that is considered a plus includes Samba administration, Citrix administration, Gemstone DBA, and Smalltalk. The job listed in this report is just one example of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit our public directory page at xrl.us/smalltalkjobs, or read my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
So, here's an example of color now. So if we say we have some object and we send it the foo message, and we give it the arguments A and B, and we say star C, which says C is an array, and I'm not treating it as a single argument, I'm treating it as a collection of arguments. Okay. So that compiles a send to the selected colon star with those three arguments. And now the bridge method, foo colon colon star on that class, then adapts the number of arguments and resends it to the real one. If we go back here and look at what the real one is foo colon star. So what that's going to do is it's going to take A and send it in as the first argument. And then it's going to take B and the array C, and it's going to make a new array with B as the first element and everything that was in C is the remainder of that array. It's going to pass that as the second argument. Yes, that's Ruby. Right. Yes?
What is the star in the sure? Because I was thinking that star was the definition.
Star can be on both the send site and the definition.
And what does it mean in the send?
It means that this is a collection of arguments. So if C is an array with four elements, saying A, B, star C in the send site is the same as sending six individual arguments. Semantically, it's exactly the same.
It's the same thing with five plus
three. Right, yeah. Same time, essentially, in the same virtual machine. We want to be able to leverage all of our existing Smalltalk code to provide persistent services, inquiries about the state of the system, all this stuff that we wrote in Smalltalk. We don't want to have to rewrite it in Ruby just to get it to run. So we want to be able to have Ruby and Smalltalk running together. And there are a number of issues with this. I'm going to talk about one in particular to illustrate some of the problems and why we came up with the solution we did. That problem is the problem of the immediate classes. Now, the immediate object is one where the pointer to the object encodes both the class of the object and the state of the object right in the pointer. So the object itself doesn't actually have to exist as an entity in memory anymore, because the pointer to the object is just actually the complete specification of the object. The most common example of this is small integers, where you have some tag bits at the bottom that says "I'm small integer," and the rest of the bits of the pointer are the value of the small integer. So it encodes the class and the value. Now, the reason we do that is because it makes things incredibly more performant if you do that. You know, if you have to have a memory allocated object for every integer, you're in trouble performance wise. So we really want to be able to use the immediate classes, the small integers and booleans and the other things that in Gemstone are immediate classes. We want to be able to use those for Ruby as well. And it fits Ruby very well because Ruby has an equivalent of small integer called fixed num and an equivalent of large integer called big num. And very much the same semantic as Smalltalk has, because you know how to use maybe Smalltalk. And so we want to be able to do that. But now the class, the Ruby class fixNum, and the Smalltalk class, small integer, have to be the same identical class. But their names are different. And the set of methods they have is different. And their superclass may be the same, or they may be different. And certainly all the superclasses of the object are going to have to probably be the same. The object has the same names, but it is a different set of methods in Ruby than it does in Smalltalk. And you don't want to just glom all those, you know, have the union of messages that object understands. Because somebody might write a program that adds a bunch of methods to the object. Ruby people do this all the time, Smalltalk people do this all the time. And that might conflict with one of the methods that's already there in the other language. So we have to come up with something doing this. So how do we do this? For once, we don't cheat. What we do is we have environment-specific behavior. James talked about this in his talk on Monday a little bit as sandboxing, which is one of the applications of it. Basically, what it allows you to do is you can have a method dictionary per class, per environment. An environment is just some thing with an identifier. There can be some relatively small number of them, certainly less than 64K, some limited number, but not a tiny, tiny number, although we're only using three or four environments right now. So you can have a method dictionary per class, per environment. Although, if you want the same behavior in a class in multiple environments, the multiple environments can share the same method dictionary for that class. And if some of the methods are the same, which is often the case, between different method dictionaries in which there are some differences, then that particular method, compiled methods, can be shared between the different method dictionaries. But each send site, everywhere there's a send bytecode in the compiled method, every send site specifies the selector and the environment that send is going to. So, by default, when you compile a Ruby method, it says, I am sending in the Ruby environment for every send in that method. And when you compile a Smalltalk method, it says, I am sending in the Smalltalk environment. And this separates the behaviors between the two. This complicates the full method lookup. You have to do the complete traversal. Complicates that a bit, because you have to pay attention to which environment it is and figure out which set of method dictionaries you're using and all that. However, once you cache the result of that lookup, the caching is pretty much the same, because every send site has every send site is specific to one environment, and that's fixed. then that result that you get back is going to be good until the normal invalidation if you change code somewhere, for instance.
Did you check what the base emotes did to support selector memory space? Because what he did at that time was he introduced some rules and he override, I guess that he overrode the equality, or he had something like equal for some rule. So this means that two symbols could be equal, or they would be only equal if they belong to the same namespace. So like that, it does not have. This means that, and then when he compiles the selector with the tag of the element. So like that in the dictionary, the compiler will only look for the right symbol.
Yes.
And then you don't have to look for all the programming in this environment because you are, because your symbol is defined in the environment.
Right. We do encode the environment into the symbol, but then we do start the lookup within the environment ID that looks at particular method dictionaries.
Because I found this trick really neat because we were always thinking, okay, how can we do something without having this extra cost, and just because he introduced that, said, oh, now we have a polymorphic symbol, and you beat.
Yeah, our symbols are, we do have a way of encoding the environment ID into the symbol when it's compiled into a method. So there aren't any actual words, you just have the selector that encodes the actual selector and the symbol. Symbol identity will be the same no matter what environment it's in. Okay. And we need to hurry a little bit up so I can reach the end before my time. Fortunately, this challenge is not that much of a challenge. In Ruby, you can add methods to individual objects, and you can also do a sort of multiple inheritance scheme by mixing in modules at the class level, which effectively adds chunks of behavior, not really quite like traits, but not that far off either. You can basically take a chunk of behavior and insert it in the lookup chain. And in fact, that's the way we implement it. Is that on an instance, if you add a method to an instance, then you basically create a virtual class that's normally invisible in its superclass chain between it and its class. That contains that extra behavior. And on the class side, if you import a module into a class, then you create have a copy of that module object, which is basically like a class. In Ruby, the module is a superclass of a class. And you make a copy of that module object and you insert it in between that class and its superclass in the lookup chain. And that's the way you do it. And so that's the way we did it. You didn't have to choose. It was easy anyway. But it was a little weird for small talkers to do that. Challenge 5, the last one we're going to look at today, is per instance variables. Okay. This one I wrote out because it's so weird to a small talk person. In Ruby, an instance variable is created by the app assigning to it. In Smalltalk, when you create an object with new, that object has at creation time, all the instance variables that we're going to have, and they are initialized to nil. In Ruby, when you create an object, it has no instance variables. Period. Ever. Yes?
In ICO, when you compile the method, if the method refers to a variable, you do the check exam?
No.
Okay.
No, you can ask a Ruby object whether it has an instance variable or a particular name. Even if there's an assignment in the next line to that instance variable name, you ask it above that, it has to answer false. That's one of the requirements. So, do you have instance variable foo? No! Then foo, colon, equal, you know, foo, at foo equals something, and then now it exists. So, that semantics is a little bit interesting to actually make.
Now a short interlude for this week's Squeak News with Randall Schwartz.
This is Randall Schwartz here with your latest Squeak News. You can find all this news and more at news.squeak.org. Hernan Wilkinson wrote to the Squeak Dev mailing list that the Smalltalks 2009 presentations are available now at the Smalltalks conference site under the Talks tab. Given that the speakers included such well-known figures as Dan Ingles, Stefan DeCasse, Alex Worth, Tim McKinnon, James Foster, and Travis Griggs, there should be some fascinating viewing to be had. Hernan added, quote, "You can watch also the video used during the presentation that summarizes the previous 2 years of conferences. It is a very nice video. It is at, and there's a YouTube location at the website." End quote. There are also links to other videos and pictures from the conference homepage. For Squeak Weekly News, this is Randall Schwartz. You can also check out my blog at methodsandmessages.vox.com.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
So, the way that Ruby does this is kind of slow, and it means that every object is sort of a dictionary. You know, has a name, value, pairs, and then the dictionary is empty when you start, and then you just add name, value, pairs to it as you assign to it. And we do that because we have to also, but it's kind of nice having fixed offsets for instance variables as well. So, when we can, we create fixed offsets for instance variables. And we initialize them to a special I'm not here value. So that if you ask if it's there, it will return false. And I believe that that is essentially another instance of undefined object that is not nil that we use for that purpose. And we have a special primitive for creating a new Ruby object that initializes all of the fixed existing slots to that value instead of initializing to nil. So, but we can't do that always. So, what you end up with is objects with a certain number of fixed named instance variables, and then there may be some name value pairs coming after that that have to be linearly searched when you're looking for a particular instance variable. And the reason for that is that finding what all possible instance variables is difficult. Now, here's the way you define a class in Ruby. So you have a class definition, and you have a method definition, and there's an assignment. At sign means I'm talking about an instance variable, and you assign it to some value, and that, when it executes, creates the instance variable. But at compile time, we can tell, hey, there's an assignment to this name, so we actually assign that fixed offset and use that. But now you've got the end of your class definition, and then sometime later, you actually parse some code that says class my example. Again, this does not create a new class. This reopens, re-enters the environment of that class, and you can define more things on it. So you can define more assignments to instance variables you didn't know before. So we don't catch those. Maybe that code isn't even in the system anywhere. Maybe it's brought in on a socket or something. No way to know. So when you execute that kind of code, then you're going to add a dynamic instance variable. Okay.
Even if you catch them, the order in which they are called means when the index of the variable.
Yes, but the index of the variable doesn't matter that much. As long as everybody knows it, you know, it's like in small talk, unless you're doing instance or that or instance or output, you can swap all the names as far as around and nobody cares.
Yes. Have you seen the VA implementation of JavaScript? Because JavaScript is very similar, it can create, and it's not possible to use the same.
I haven't looked at what they did.
Because what they do is they change the pointer to the class. I mean, if there is a new instance variable, they create like a new class, subclass, you know, hidden subclass, and then
right.
And so now they're not using dictionaries anymore.
Yeah. We're trying to do a hybrid between that because if you're doing it a lot, it's expensive to keep modifying your individual classes and there's extra objects and the cost of that gets very high. So this one we try to catch as many as we can up front and make them static and then do this afterwards. We've talked about having some maintenance operations on persistent objects that are long-lived to go through and actually, you know, as a maintenance sweep to roll through and find all the dynamic instance variables and roll them up into the fixed instance variables, but we're not doing that. Okay, I am basically out of time, so let's rush through the rest of it. Okay, over time we've gotten to pass a lot more tests. You can't read this probably, but back here in October of 08, we were passing about 3,600 of the core, this is the Ruby compliance test. As of like a couple of weeks ago, we were passing 18,600, nearly all. So you can see that we have a lot more challenges other than the ones I've talked about to deal with over the last year. There's 24,000, so we're passing almost 19,000 out of 24,000. So we're getting there. We can't maintain this rate of increase for very long because we're going to run out of tests. Okay. So, did we make the right choice in choosing Smalltalk? Okay, everybody knows the answer to that. Yes, we did. Okay. And why did we, you know, why was Smalltalk so great? It's because Smalltalk lets us. Okay. It's not really cheating. It's just using a tool that lets you do really cool stuff. And that's not cheating, that's smart. Okay.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the Industry Misinterpretations podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.